in studio together. It was the night before the election. We were full of hope, optimism, and we had our pants hiked up for the impending blue wave, should it come. And
I didn't.
It did.
I didn't have my pants hiked up.
Well, we know how the Republicans reacted to that. We got hit by a blue wave that has the force of 10,000 lakes here in Minnesota.
That's right. Yeah, we did. It didn't happen nationwide, but certainly in Minnesota, it was a night to remember.
This is Brad and Max filling in for Walter Hudson tonight on Closing Argument.
Brad, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with me. We've got Brianne producing the show, taking your calls. Your calls welcome, 651-989-5855. Now, Max, we were talking before the show that it's almost the holidays now officially. We're on Thanksgiving week. I can smell the turkey being roasted already. And you said that things start to slow down, but I don't think I felt that yet. Like, have you slept since the election?
Yeah, I took the whole week after the election to sleep. In fact, so I am I'm hibernated. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to finish up the year. I'm ready to get my eat on come Thanksgiving. But it was certainly an interesting night. I was actually with Walter at the GOP event. And unlike 2016, which was one of the more memorable times of my life, 2018, listen, we had polls open up and the Senate races got called right when the polls opened up. Tina Smith's race got called right away. It was like, what is going on? And there's been lots of prognosticating and lots of predicting since then. And I think at the end of the day, we got some soul searching to do as Minnesota Republicans.
You do indeed. I think I was in here operating the board and producing the show from the studio, and
yes,
the most noticeable thing to me was just how the air just seemed to get sucked out of the room when the results started coming in. You could feel it through the radio.
Well, what nobody talks about, and this was very interesting, before any of the polls closed at that party, Nate Silver's website, 538, had actually predicted that in real time, their kind of algorithm, their live tracking of each race, it was predicting that the House would actually pick up seats, the House would pick up seats, according to Nate Silver's predictions early on in the night. So not only were we let down by the results when they eventually came in, but earlier in the night, and again, nobody talks about this because of what the end result was, Nate Silver was predicting that the House would not only remain in GOP control, but actually we would gain seats. So everybody had this false sense of confidence and started drinking early in hopes of a good outcome. And then, lo and behold, our worst nightmares came true. We not only got, or not only lost every statewide race, as many of you know, as all of you know, I'm sure, who are listening, but the biggest decimation happened in the suburbs. We lost every state house seat we possibly could. We lost state house seats that were presumably safe. So it was about as disastrous as it could possibly be.
As we say in Minnesota, oof-da.
It was that.
So we're here exercising our First Amendment right tonight, and that seems to be the A topic today. We were kind of looking at what's the biggest talker today, and that seems to be the story surrounding Jim Acosta and his press pass in the White House. I'll tell you what, if you have a First Amendment right to a press pass in the White House, then I'll take mine, Mr. President.
Yeah, I will tell you, this is just another one of those contrived, ridiculous stories where the media personality is making the story about themselves. Yeah, and that is one of the funniest things, right? Listening to reporters and journalists say, you know, I don't want to be part of the story. I'm not trying to make myself be part of the story. We just go where the story is, or something like that. Nowhere is that more apparently false than in the person of Jim Acosta. He's making it all about himself.
Yeah, a judge recently reinstated his press pass for at least 14 days, this according to Vice News. But Trump insists that, or the White House insists, I don't know if it's Trump, the White House, you know, the royal we.
Same thing.
In the same, that they will revoke his press pass again after these 14 days have passed. So it's setting up for a fight. I think that, you know, you're talking about Jim Acosta's making the show about himself, but this has actually been an emerging trend in journalism for a while.
Sure.
I noticed it first maybe 5 years ago with ESPN.
Okay.
And kind of the echo chamber that became their talk shows, because the story wasn't about what was going on in sports necessarily, and the story today isn't about what's going on in politics. It's about what's going on in journalism, and they're creating echo chambers and storylines for themselves. It's just, oh, X says Y about Z. What does A think about Z?
And, oh, yeah.
You know, X responds to A, and...
Well, listen, even like outlets like the Huffington Post, they basically write stories on, hey, check out what this random Twitter troll said. Here are 16 other Twitter trolls saying things that are like that. It just what passes for journalism today is just borderline disgraceful. But to your point, this whole White House press corps thing, it's a joke. From the whole like celebration that they have, the White House press ball,
correspondence dinner.
Yeah, the correspondence dinner, to how they actually conduct themselves in questioning the president and just their presence in and of themselves, it's a total joke. As the president, if you looked at that exchange between him and Jim Acosta, I thought, and I try to be objective, I'm certainly a partisan, but I try my best to look at things objectively, and that whole exchange, I thought, on Acosta's end, was a total joke. Him constantly just interrupting the president.
He knew what he was doing.
Well, yeah, but it's activism. It's not inquisitive journalism.
Yeah, I agree.
At some point in time, the president was like, well, that's not happening, or the something about the caravan, it's not happening. And then Jim Acosta was like, well, that's not true, Mr. President. That's not true. That's not true. And then he wouldn't elaborate on why that wasn't true. He just kept saying that's not true and filibustering. But we live in weird times. This is a weird timeline.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is officially activist journalism, and you see people... I mean, it's running rampant now, even all the late night talk shows from Colbert and Kimmel and Fallon and Seth Meyers. It's all political, so it's natural that it would creep into actual journalism too as well. And Trump has said some things that have concerned me about the media in terms of what the First Amendment means and the right to freedom of press. I think that some of the things are concerning. But Jim Acosta is not doing himself or the press any favors by behaving like this either. People talk about the decorum of the president. Well, right back at you, you know, look in the mirror and see the decorum of the press and how,
sure,
you know, as you say, they're just making up stories about 16 trolls on Twitter. And part of that is too, as someone who has done some freelance writing online, the philosophy that I took with it was make a BLT out of crumbs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what these people are doing. They're getting clicks, they're getting likes, they're getting reaction. And so it's not necessarily about what the truth is. They're simply responding to a market demand and a market incentive to make money and get attention. And part of that too is because the market demands it. We as Americans, we as consumers, aren't that concerned with the truth.
Right. Right.
As we've seen since about 2015.
I think it's been long before that. I think it's basically, I would say it's probably been festering for the last 30 years, you know. And to your point, Brad, you know, it was Norm MacDonald, the comedian, who said that actually Trump is bringing out bad comedians, is uplifting bad comedians, because to your point, these late night shows too, a lot of these comedians are just not funny at all and have made all of their content about Donald Trump, whether it's true or not. But listen, what I think the last at least 10 years have revealed to me is that we just wear whatever partisan glasses we want to wear. That's the truth that we live in. The fact that somebody finds Seth Meyers late night funny is that to me just doesn't compute. The guy is not funny at all. He just bashes Trump and everyone does this this NPC laugh that we just follow along with.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be there's got to be a calculated decision behind it too of some sort, maybe from an executive level. You know, I'm not going to go all big brother, but these executives know too, like where the money is and where their audience is. They know that a late night audience watching anytime from 11:30 p.m. to 12:30 p.m. or 12:30 a.m. is going to be younger. It's going to be liberal. They're coming from New York in a big city, so they generally know that their audience is liberal too, and so they're just leaning that way because they know it's safe. They have liberal privilege, so to speak, to speak out on their platform, whereas Republicans, we don't have that platform.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though, that you mentioned that, because there is a certain demographic that pays attention to late-night television. Me and my wife, we don't even watch television.
Right.
So what I find interesting is, like, shows like Jay Leno's, for instance, they kept bringing Jay Leno back because they couldn't find somebody to garner the ratings that Jay Leno was getting in Jimmy Fallon's current time slot. Well, Jay Leno is a relatively conservative guy, and he had this corny humor that appealed to a demographic that is certainly not millennial. But I do find it interesting that they've decided to take this route. And in the meantime, you do see CNN, you see a couple of other cable outlets that have gone totally anti-Trump in their narrative, and their ratings are suffering because of it. There was just a story that I had read today that CNN is losing out to Nickelodeon in terms of ratings. So that goes, I don't know, it almost seems like this dogmatic religious thing that they need to participate in, all the while sacrificing their ratings. I mean, look at all of the award shows that are happening. The award shows are just anti-Trump screed, and it's a collective church, basically. And the Grammys are suffering, the Emmys, all of these award shows. You're getting hit on ratings because they're alienating half their audience.
Yeah, it's like I said, liberal privilege. And I think that what might have sparked it actually was it's kind of a Jon Stewart show in a different format. You know, they're still trying to move forward with the late night talk show format, but they're discussing news and trying to have political humor in the same way that Jon Stewart did. And you saw that shift when Stephen Colbert took over for Letterman. Stephen Colbert stepped out of his Bill O'Reilly type character,
of course,
and I think he saw it as his chance to say what he wanted to say and what he actually believed, and people liked it, and so the others followed in that direction. And I think that, you know, that's a minor part of it, because obviously there's larger forces at play as well, but I think that was a bit of a turning point as well that I think a lot of people overlook. This is Brad and Max in for Walter tonight on Closing Argument. Your calls welcome, 651-989-5855. We'll be right back on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
3.5 FM.
You know, tonight, most of our stories, at least for this hour, kind of stem from controversies in the White House. But it was interesting because, you know, like I said last segment, before the show, thinking about what was the A topic today, there wasn't particularly one that stood out over the other.
Slow news day.
A little bit. I mean, despite it's been quantity over quality, which is a weird thing to think about, because this is Trump's America now.
Yeah, we are at the speed of Trump, which is John Gilmore's saying, but we certainly, it seems like everything is just breaking all the time.
Yeah, things that would be, you know, months-long controversies in years past are now just, it's not that big of a deal anymore. Probably the 1A or 1B story today, I think, is that Democrats Democratic senators are suing over Whitaker's appointment as attorney general. That from the Associated Press. Basically, the Democrats' arguments are that the Senate has to appoint or has to approve appointments, and Trump has not allowed the Senate to do that. He never sent it through that process, because I think Trump's justification was that it's a interim appointment or a temporary appointment until they can find a real attorney general. You know, he's the acting attorney general right now,
sure.
Mr. Whitaker is. So I think that was what Trump was hiding behind. But I don't know. I think the Democratic senators might have a point here.
I don't know.
Because...
how so? How do you think they have a point?
Because Trump didn't bring in someone from... Whitaker was not previously working in the Attorney General's office. He didn't ascend, or it wasn't any sort of ascent, or what's that, the term? He didn't ascend to it from the office, or he wasn't the next in line for the job.
Yeah.
Trump just kind of put him there. And if it's a new appointment to the office, it should go through the Senate, because that's the Senate's job. Was it Trump that mocking someone on Twitter that, oh, well, Robert Mueller wasn't appointed either. But the thing with Mueller is that Mueller was appointed by the Attorney General's office. So the Attorney General has the power to make appointments within the Attorney General's office, but Trump does not have the power to make an appointment as an executive to lead the Attorney General's office without advice and consent from the Senate.
Yeah, and that's true, and that's constitutional. At the end of the day, I think it is... There are certainly loopholes that he's following to try to get this guy appointed as an interim, to your point. But I just don't see what the huge deal is. We'll see what happens with this lawsuit. But at the end of the day, it sounds like the reason that the Democrats are kind of up in arms about this is because they want to protect Mueller's investigation, and this guy is an outspoken critic of both Hillary Clinton, the origins of this investigation, and it's, you certainly can't make the constitutional argument, actually, that Donald Trump is doing the right thing, but at the end of the day, the investigation is a total sham.
Well, here at the end of this story from the Associated Press... The Federal Vacancies Reform Act allows an acting official to serve in a vacant position for up to 210 days, though the official may continue serving while a president's nomination to that position is pending before the Senate. So he's still within that 210-day window, obviously.
Okay.
But it's not before the Senate either, so I think that's kind of an either-or situation, I'm reading it.
Yeah, but does it take 210 days to advise and consent on an executive role? I think Trump can let Whitaker probably serve out half his term, half his 210 days and bring somebody up. If it, you know, however long the Supreme Court picks took, 60 days or whatever it was, it's probably a good timeline.
Yeah, but I think I was thinking back about the story today, and I remember there was a controversy during the Obama administration with the National Labor Relations Board. You know, I said that the president doesn't have the power to appoint someone to an office without advice consent from the Senate, but that has been amended since then, that the president can make recess appointments and then retroactively have the advice and consent of the Senate. And Obama did that with the National Labor Relations Board when he was president, and there was some consternation from Republicans, and those folks stuck around because they were recess appointments. But Trump did not make this appointment during a recess, but I think that's what he's going to rely on now over the holidays, now that everyone goes home for Thanksgiving and Christmas and through the New Year, and then things will pick back up again after in 2019. But this will be another chip for both parties to play. They both kind of know that they can use it to their benefit in terms of, well, Democrats are trying to do this to us, oh, Republicans are trying to do this to us. So... well, they both claim that they have the power to do one thing or the other. They're also kind of holding on to that power as long as they can, or holding on, you know.
Well, that's the point. That is the point. If you want the appointment, if you want the power of the appointment, or to not deny power of the appointment, get the majority, get the gavel. It's electoral victory, life or death, win or lose, and that's kind of how it goes. especially, by the way, because of Harry Reid's filibuster reform. So in 2013, listen, people, constitutionally, advice and consent means a two-third majority vote. Could you imagine?
60.
Originally, it was a two-thirds.
Oh, sure.
A two-thirds vote to effectively consent to whatever appointment the president was going to make. Now, that's not the case anymore. One, and first and foremost, because of Harry Reid's filibuster reform that he was so proud of in 2013 to make it a simple majority. Could you imagine if Supreme Court picks were still a two-thirds vote that needed to happen? In today's political climate, I don't see how a Kavanaugh gets through, or a Gorsuch for that matter, because we forget Gorsuch slid through by the skin of his teeth too, and there was nothing wrong with that guy. Nothing.
Well, yeah, that reform came to bite the Democrats in the butt, and I've said it before that good policy comes from good procedure, and we wouldn't have had anything, the whole hubbub with the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the sexual assault allegations, that wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have even been necessary if they wouldn't have switched it from 60 votes to 50. Kavanaugh may not have gotten by on 60 votes, just like Gorsuch may not have. So these checks...
I think in today's political climate, I don't know if Trump would have a single appointment.
Well, these natural checks and balances are in the system for a reason. This is what the Founding Fathers intended. If Kavanaugh was confirmed with 50 votes, not even a majority of the members present, but not a majority of the body...
The Senate itself.
As a whole.
Yes.
Yep. You know, they had... What was it, 98 or 99 people present?
Yeah.
So he had a quorum, but 50 votes is not even a majority of the actual sitting senators. And I think that is atrocious. I'm not going to go out and say that Kavanaugh is an illegitimate pick or anything, but I'm making the point that we need to think about the procedure and the policy that comes from that.
No, I think we're so far beyond that, Brad, that it's just take your electoral victories and club your opponent over the head with it. That's kind of where we're at right now. And there's no doubt about it. If and when Democrats retain power, it's not like they're going to be the pillar of virtue that they're trying to establish in the Senate right now. They'll just do what they'll do what their majority allows them to do.
Well, myself as a person with a political science degree, it is a tortured existence. You're the only one with a degree, but everyone has an opinion. This is Brad and
it's
Max
America.
In for a closing argument with Walter Hudson, 9 to 11 weeknights. On Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
We'll update you on the fight for 15 and why it's likely to happen statewide.
Plus, everything the FDA gets wrong about vaping.
Justice and Drew, live and local, 6 to 9, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Would they call this yacht rock? I feel like I should be like on a boat on Lake Minnetonka, sipping a few brewskis.
That does sound really nice.
It's a little cold for that right now, but that's what this song puts me in the mood for. This is Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Brad Omland and Max Reimer filling in for Walter tonight on Closing Argument. Your call is welcome, 651-989-5855. Now, another thing Trump is working on from the White House is this criminal justice reform bill. Actually, initially when it was announced, received bipartisan support, but Max here says that may not quite be the case.
Yeah, well, it sounds, and this is so pathetic, it sounds like House Democrats are not going to vote yes on this thing. It sounds like especially black House Democrats are opposed to it. And when you actually look at what this bill is, it's the First Step Act, so it needs to pass the Senate, and we'll see what happens, but overall, it does a lot of good things for criminal justice sentencing, especially. So less harsh sentencing for drug offenses, nonviolent criminals, that kind of thing. There's even little caveats in there about record expungement and just things that have bipartisan, and you hear that word all the time. Oh, this is bipartisan, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is really, I think, actually bipartisan and actually a direction that I think Republicans probably need to go down in order to build a broader coalition, especially in Minnesota. It's one of my prescriptions to how Republicans can do a little bit better in the urban core and in CD5 and that kind of thing. But this is a long time coming. It's something that other administrations, again, had talked about. And it really does reform kind of a decades-old justice system in a good, positive way. There are good things in the bill itself. And again, you see Democrats cutting their nose to spite their face in a lot of ways just to oppose this man in the White House. I can't imagine that this is not a good thing for a bunch of different constituencies.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. You said that black Democrats were not going to support the bill. But it would be interesting to see if they're reaching that conclusion on their own for their own political ends, or are they hearing that from their constituents?
Sure. Or is it the right or the wrong thing to do? I tend to think that the Democrats are doing it for their own political maneuvering.
Absolutely.
One example of what's in the bill is the three strikes rule. So three felonies, three, it could be drug crimes, that kind of thing. This was passed under Bill Clinton and it triggers a life sentence for people. Well, this bill overhauls it, overtakes it, and reforms it to only trigger a 25-year sentence. Now that's a pretty dramatic difference. People forget about how harsh some of these reforms were under Bill Clinton for nonviolent drug offenses, and minority communities especially were hit hard in the Clinton administration because his wife Hillary doesn't like minorities either. So all that to be said, this administration is finally doing something of substance for our justice system, and for Democrats to oppose that in any form or fashion, it just seems baffling to me, because these are people who constantly bleat about how Republicans don't care about, one, the poor, two, minorities. You hear the drumbeat all the time. Well, the Trump administration is spearheading something that implicitly helps those communities and restores neighborhoods, restores fatherhood, does a lot of good things for a lot of different, like I say, constituencies. And for Democrats to oppose this, just to oppose Donald Trump, it makes no sense to me.
Well, there's an article here from Reason that talks about how Trump doesn't actually know the specifics of the bill, despite it being written out in two forms already. That's not necessarily surprising. You know, Trump had an interview with the Daily Caller here, according to Reason, where he kind of gave the Trump speak of, well, we're working on many things, criminal justice reform, we're working on very hard, we have a meeting today, do you know that, we have a meeting today, and kind of the average Trump speak. But I think what is interesting here is, you know, you're talking that Democrats in the House might not support it, but what they actually might be doing here, according to Reason, is pulling the unfriendly amendment, where they are going to take the opportunity to, since they control the House, to propose greater reforms or more extreme reforms than Republicans had presented. And because those are further than Republicans had wanted, Republicans won't support it, and they can, again, make hay out of the process.
See, and this is the sick part about all of this, is it's a good bill, period. Lives are at stake, real lives. People who have not necessarily been wrongly convicted, but wrongly over-convicted in a lot of ways. And to play political football with something like this, listen, if you want more extreme reform, pass this bill and then let's have another conversation on it. This is a good starting point. And it's sick. It is sick what politicians are willing to do with people's lives. This is a reform that needs to happen. And I think for Republicans to initiate it, to be worried first and foremost about political points that you can score, proves that you don't actually care about people. You don't actually care about people who are incarcerated or wrongly incarcerated.
Well, I'm trying to look up the standing rule that we have here on Closing Argument. You can check out our standing rules for the show on our Facebook page. Just search Closing Argument with Walter Hudson.
Did I break one?
No, I think you're touching on one, and I just want to get the official language here that we have in our rules, that the left doesn't actually care about justice or truth. They only care about political gains, as you say.
As a principle, though, if Donald Trump doesn't exactly know what's in a bill, and I'm serious about this, who cares? I'm dead serious. Who cares if he doesn't know every single word in a bill? If Donald Trump is spending all of his time perusing over bills and seeing the exact text, bills are supposed to be authored and passed, authored and passed through the chambers of Congress. Donald Trump can then sign him based on the principle, but before something even hits his desk, for you to expect that Donald Trump knows every single word of a bill, it's again this fascinating double standard if you think that President Obama was reading every ounce of every bill that he ever signed.
No, I agree, but at least Obama was well-spoken enough to make it sound like he knew what he was talking about.
Is that a consolation?
Whereas...
Is it?
Maybe. I mean, at least with Trump, it's like, okay, yeah, he's just salesmaning it up. Whereas with Obama, he sounded good, and it's like, oh, yeah, he might actually know what he's talking about. So I see your point where people might be... People see the salesman in Trump, but they don't see that in Obama, and that can be particularly deceiving. But the rule here, closing arguments, standing rules, rule number 7, the left does not now and cannot ever value truth, justice, science, compassion, or dignity.
Ooh. It's a lot of things that they don't value.
Check it out here on our Facebook page, Closing Argument with Walter Hudson, under the notes section. But then, you know, rule number 8, the right only matters in so much as it opposes the left. It does not compete with it. So that's kind of the dilemma that Republicans are left with. They're not taking the moral high ground with this bill and calling Democrats on their bluff, where, as you say, lives are at stake. In the political process, Republicans haven't gone that far in doing that yet. We'll see what happens when the bill hits the floor, when the bill hits committee. But again, it'll be interesting because there is one version in the Republican-controlled Senate, but support for the bill in the Senate among Republicans seems more lukewarm or less enthusiastic than perhaps Republicans in the House, or where the popular will of the people exists. There seems to be more enthusiasm for it than kind of the old stuffy conservative side.
Well, and to that end, according to the New York Times story on the bill itself, like the Fraternal Order of Police and a couple of other organizations have adamantly come out against it. So, but it's interesting because those would be kind of old guard Republican groups that Senate Republicans would care about. But it appears that this thing does have the momentum to move forward. And again, it's a good bill. It moves the ball forward in a morally direct, right way. And for us to oppose it and play political football with this type of stuff, I just do not. It's not contrived outrage on my part. I do find it outrageous. I really do.
Yeah, I think your outrage is legitimate. And this was the first bill where I read and I was like, you know, generally when they say bipartisan, that means that larger than usual deception is a front.
Of course.
But I read through it and I'm like, there's not anything in this bill that I see that is bad or would really catch me off guard or make me not want to support it. I mean, we'll see how it goes through again in the process, because it'll have amendments. It'll have, you know, additions to it so that people will vote for, you know, some senator will say, oh, can you get my pork barrel project in with this? Because that's how I'm going to vote for it. So
yes,
it will change in that way. And then, you know, like I said, there's a different version in the Senate, a different version in the House, both controlled by different parties. If the bill does pass both those chambers, it will have to go to a reconciliation committee and come out completely different, in a completely different form from there, before it even hits Trump's desk. So a long ways to go here on this criminal justice reform bill, but this might actually be the Republicans' opportunity to take the moral high ground and say that, you know, turn the left's language against them and say, when they say that lives are at stake. This is Closing Argument. Brad and Max filling in for Walter tonight. Your calls welcome, 651-989-5855. You're listening to Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Justin Reed. You're listening to Closing Argument with Walter Hudson.
Tuesday morning on Justice and Drew, we got Sam's Top 5, the fight for 15, the war on vaping, and more.
Listen live 6 to 9 on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Twin Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. My name is Brad Omland, in studio tonight with Max Reimer, filling in for Closing Argument with Walter Hudson. Breaking down the stories of the day, mostly what is emerging in controversial news from Trump's White House. Of course, that's not necessarily new news that there's controversy in the White House, but certainly plenty of storyline today that we are making a lot of hay out of. And the last one tonight, I think, is maybe the most complex or the most esoteric, in that we don't know, you know, I don't think the average man on the street has a lot of opinions on what's going on in Saudi Arabia. But as you may remember, there was a journalist killed in Saudi Arabia. His name was Khashoggi. I think that's how we agreed that we're pronouncing it, right?
I think so.
And we're trying to reach a conclusion on how he was murdered or what the motive was for his murder. And the CIA this weekend came out and said that a Saudi prince was responsible for it. This, according to Reuters here, that the CIA blamed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Trump is calling this very premature, but said he will review the complete report on the case on Tuesday. Now, this is interesting. There's more analysis here from the Wall Street Journal. Basically says that this story will complicate Saudi relations with the U.S. or Trump's relations with Saudi Arabia. As you may remember, Jared Kushner was involved with the Saudis in the Middle East, and kind of, he was Trump's point man in the Middle East and still is to some extent, I believe. But Trump
said that Jared Kushner was going to bring peace to the Middle East.
And so far that hasn't happened, as we see here with the killing of a Turkish journalist. And it is interesting because, I mean, this is all a symptom of how involved the U.S. is overseas, and the back channeling going on, and the arms funding, and the war, you know, the war games. And so it's not surprising that stuff like this is happening. But Trump doesn't want to go out and throw the Saudi prince under the bus because he still sees some benefit or gain from working with Saudi Arabia, whatever is on his agenda. I don't know what the final, you know, what is Trump's ultimate goal? Is it peace in the Middle East, and will he accomplish that through Saudi Arabia? I'm not so sure. You know, we have to keep in mind that Saudi Arabia was actually the government behind 9/11, not the governments in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right, right.
So it's a little dangerous, just like friending with Putin. I think this is equally as treacherous for the
U.S. But listen, Donald Trump is right in when he says there are a lot of bad people out there. I got to be honest, when this story first came out, and it sounds like this Khashoggi suffered a really gruesome death, like really dark parts of the internet type stuff, but I got to be honest, I can't bring myself to care about this story as much as other people seem to want to care about it. When you think about who we do business with already, so we know who Saudi Arabia is. There are far worse things that they're doing on really a daily basis from a human rights violation standpoint. But we have trade partnerships with China, who by the way is basically a heinous government and still dictatorship in a lot of ways. But then beyond that, a lot of the countries that we're either involved with in some foreign policy fashion or at war with or assisting in war commit atrocities all the time. Now, this happens to be a journalist, which probably raises the stakes a little bit for some people because we want free speech everywhere. But I don't see what the huge deal is besides a guy dying.
Well, I mean, that's the classic ethnocentric American attitude, and I don't blame you for it, because I think that a lot of people feel the way that you do, and like I said, it's esoteric. It's difficult to understand.
Should we declare war? Should we declare
no,
war?
No, absolutely not. I'm not trying to spend Christmas in Saudi Arabia.
You have senators saying it's an act of war if they've done what they're accused of doing.
Well, I mean, that's basically how World War I started. It's, you know, one person got assassinated and then the whole world was at war. So it's not unprecedented, you could say, but I think that those senators may be hopefully a little bit ahead of themselves. And like I said, maybe the saving grace, you know, I say that Trump, it's a little concerning that he wants to have a relationship with these guys, but maybe at the same time, that is what is preventing us from going to war, is the fact that he wants to remain friendly, and he's not. Trump himself is not rattling the saber.
Honestly, you know, yeah, we can get back to it probably, but I'm cool with sanctions, but people want to go to war over this. I'm not ready to do that.
Next hour, Condoleezza Rice in the NFL.
What?
We'll talk about it here on Closing Argument. Brad and Max filling in for Walter tonight on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. The Rage Against the Machine intro means that Walter is out tonight. Brad and Max are in as Walter fills in or attends to his municipal duties up in Albertville.
Walter is a lame duck right now, so he's probably passing some pretty radical stuff.
Yeah, they're legalizing marijuana up there. They're
in Albertville.
Legalizing prostitution. It's just going to become Vegas all of a sudden.
Hey, Walter is one of the guys, and he said this on his show the other night, so I feel I can certainly repeat it. He's one of those guys that was caught up in the blue wave.
Actually, he was caught up in the radio waves.
Well, both.
You know, it was interesting because...
He lost.
You know, the FCC has regulations that state if you're an active candidate for office, you can't be on the air because of equal time. But since Walter was just running for city council in an outer ring suburb, it was probably going to be okay. But the regulation exists so that a candidate, you know, like Jason Lewis doesn't have the opportunity to just have 2 hours of free press and airtime for himself.
That's a terrible law. That's a terrible regulation.
Obviously, it doesn't work out in all cases.
I can't believe Walter had this platform to reach his centralized audience in Albertville and still came up short.
Yeah, we're not as popular as we think we are sometimes, I guess.
It sounds like Walter has been very gracious in defeat and that his opponent worked very hard. That's what I've heard.
That is the news I'm getting as well.
Brad and Max, the leader in Albertville political coverage.
we are. We must be.
Very niche.
So we teased on the at the end of the last hour that Condoleezza Rice could be coming to the NFL. You may have heard this story over the weekend as the NFL tends to dominate on our Sundays. But the Browns were reportedly set to interview Condoleezza Rice, the former, she was Secretary of State in the Bush administration. And, of course, if you don't know, Condoleezza Rice was a Browns fan growing up. Watching with her grandparents, I believe, in Birmingham, Alabama. That was from CNN. So she has a connection to the Browns, I guess, and knows the owners. And then, of course, ESPN's Adam Schefter reported that the Browns were interested in interviewing her after they had fired head coach Hugh Jackson earlier this season.
And Adam Schefter is about the best source you can go to for NFL information. It's not some speculative, weird third party that reported it. Adam Schefter is the leading voice in NFL breaking news. So, you know what? Condoleezza Rice came out and denied it. The Browns GM, John Dorsey, came out and denied it. But if Adam Schefter is reporting it, this is the really weird part. If he's reporting it, you can almost regard that as truth in some form or fashion.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Condoleezza Rice herself denied it. She came out and graciously... passed on the offer, but I think it was the Browns organization themselves that denied this from Reuters and CNBC, that the Cleveland Browns denied the report. This was from Sunday, it looked like. And I think, you know, Condoleezza Rice made a statement passing on the offer, obviously. But I don't know if you want to laugh at this or give the Browns credit for thinking outside the box, because the Browns certainly need it. If there's any team that needs
they're terrible.
Something totally different, it's the Browns. So for them to come out and announce, or for there to be a report that the Browns were thinking about offering the gig or interviewing someone completely different outside the NFL for the job, I'm not surprised, you could say.
And in Condoleezza's statement, she had made mention of she's not going to take it, but she wishes that there were more female NFL coaches. You don't need to play the game. There should be a better farm system for females who want to be involved in the NFL. And I don't disagree with any of that. Some of the smarter football minds I know, like Lindsay Young, who works for the Vikings, is female, and she knows the game is as good as anybody does. And you don't necessarily need to play something in order to understand it or motivate people. And that was kind of Lisa Rice's sentiment. So I don't necessarily disagree with any of that. But come on, that is a joke. It really is. And Condoleezza Rice, you can be good at something, but it's honestly like saying, hey, you know, what happened if one day Donald Trump was like, hey, I want Nick Saban, Alabama's head coach, to be my Secretary of State. Could you imagine the outrage? It's admitting that a position doesn't take a skill set, right? It's admitting that because Condoleezza Rice has Secretary of State experience or robust, amazing resume when it comes to political experience, that somehow, and being a fan of football, that somehow translates to running a football team. The fact that the Browns were even flirting with this, and like I said, if Adam Schefter is reporting it, that means that there was something that happened. I think you must be a really, really desperate organization.
They are?
Of course they are. But to say that you can have zero experience coaching football or being associated with any NFL team at any level beyond just being a fan entitles you to the role of head coach or gives you credentials to be a head coach, come on. That's a joke.
Your opinions welcome. 651-989-5855. Brianne producing the show, taking your calls tonight. Brad and Max filling in for Walter tonight on Closing Argument here on Twin Cities News Talk. I think, like I said, it's a strategic move. I think that if you can bring out someone, or if you can bring in someone from outside your organization who's obviously smart, obviously very qualified and respected in terms
in
of...
In what field?
In
football?
In politics, but... I mean, football still is it's a sport of egos. It's a sport of strategic thinking. It's a sport of outthinking your opponent and having, you know, you want to be the last person with the pen. You want to have the best pieces on the board. So in terms of that skill set, I think that Condoleezza Rice has it. Whether that applies to football or not, I'm not so sure. I don't know if Condoleezza Rice would get on the field and go, do that thing where you run 5 yards deep beyond the linebackers and then cut up field. Like, a wide receiver might go, a chair?
Condoleezza Rice and I have the same credentials when it comes to wanting to coach a football team. We both love football. I could be the Packers head coach. And by the way, I think I should be the Packers head coach because the Packers' current head coach is terrible. I would be as qualified to run the Green Bay Packers as Condoleezza Rice would be qualified to run the Cleveland Browns. We both have the same amount of experience in football, and we would both, quite frankly, be terrible at the job. And the fact that we're even having a legitimate conversation about this, one, it shows how ridiculous and terrible the Cleveland Browns are, and two, it kind of shows you how topsy-turvy our entire world is and our timeline is, because this is not a serious conversation. The fact that the Browns were vetting her, it's baffling.
We're like seeing the infiltration of politics into the NFL from the other side now. You know, we had this bottom up thing with Colin Kaepernick and the anthem, but now this is this top down league owners, league officials are considering someone with a political background to run a team. So we're seeing the opposite response to the political invasion of everything within our world. So it's certainly an interesting development. And if they want to hire her as a consultant, at least, I think it might be a good strategic move.
Sure. And there has actually been talk before about Condoleezza Rice being the next commissioner of the NFL, which I would find interesting because you have led businesses, you have led bureaucracies, which the NFL as an organization is certainly a bureaucracy, and navigating that takes a certain skill set. But my goodness, to develop a playbook, to develop a coaching staff, these are things that you accumulate acumen on when you spend your time in football. And again, we would not be even giving this levity if Adam Schefter did not report it. Because again, it's important to emphasize, when Adam Schefter reports something, it means something in some form or fashion actually happened. And there was probably a line of communication open with Condoleezza Rice about coming in and coaching this football team, which again, you don't have credentials to do that.
Yeah, some of it is just understanding the nuances of the system. But
no, honest to God, think about if Donald Trump, and this is not beyond Donald Trump, I suppose, but to say, I like Nick Saban, he's a winner, he's going to be my next Secretary of State, we would all be like, what?
If Alabama still had ambassador somewhere, I'm sure that Nick Saban would be the first person that people from Alabama appointed. But we've got some calls on the issue here with Condoleezza Rice. Your calls, welcome to 651-989-5855. Let's go to Jim from Burnsville. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Hey, I heard yesterday, too, that Condoleezza Rice on football that the Browns front office was putting up names out there, certain individuals, to see who was leaking information from their front office. So probably wasn't a serious thing, but they tossed it out there to see who actually leaked it to the press.
Oh, interesting. Kind of putting some dye in the water there?
Correct. So if they had several ideas and they threw it out there to a couple of individuals, then they can narrow it down who's actually leaking information that they don't want to be up, you know, have out there.
Yeah, that makes sense. I appreciate that perspective. I had not heard that before. That's another thing we've seen both in the White House and among NFL teams, who is leaking. And so that's an interesting strategy from the Browns there to maybe put some dye in the water and see where the information is coming out. I know that it's interesting that the Browns fired their coach, what was it, like 4 weeks, 5 weeks into the season, and now they're looking for somebody else here. Maybe, to Jim's point, it wasn't maybe necessarily to find out who was leaking, but to get some attention for the job. Say that, hey, remember guys, this job is still out here.
Oh my gosh.
It's interesting because any other good candidates, you know, like the next in line candidates, like when Pat Shurmur was the offensive coordinator for the Vikings and then became the head coach in New York, you know, those coordinator guys aren't necessarily in a good spot to leave their teams right now. So the Browns are kind of in a precarious spot of just, again, tanking another season, riding it out, and seeing what Baker Mayfield can do to entertain fans in the meantime.
The Browns should do one of two things. If they are gonna go that route, and you know, the conspiracy theory about finding out who leaked, that could be a very interesting angle, and I did hear that as well. But listen, if Adam Schefter reports it, there is some meat there. And then beyond that, the Browns should honestly post a position on Craigslist if this is the route that they're gonna go. They should post it on Craigslist, or they should hire Anthony Scaramucci or some other kind of Trump also ran, because again, there's about as much experience there as there would be with any.
Maybe they'll take Mike McCarthy off your hands.
Well, Mike McCarthy is a terrible coach. I actually would rather take Condoleezza Rice over Mike McCarthy, but that's a special exception.
This is Brad and Max in for Walter Hudson tonight on Closing Argument, mixing some sports and politics, which are certainly my favorite topics. Your call is welcome, 651-989-5855. We continue on the other side of the break on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5. If you live in the Southwest Metro, life is about to change. Late last week, news broke here from the Pioneer Press that the $2 billion Minneapolis to Eden Prairie light rail project is cleared to begin construction. Equipment staging and ground clearing happening basically now, going to happen this winter. It's starting. This Southwest light rail project that will cost $2 billion.
The Met Council found the money and found the bonding. Good thing we did not re-elect the only champion who was going to take on the Southwest Light Rail and the Met Council and Jason Lewis. And we did not elect a governor who will rein in the power of the Met Council. So there you have it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because it might be one of those relative deprivation things where people in the Southwest Metro say that they don't like it, and it'll be disruptive, and I don't doubt that it will be so, especially during construction time. But those people might move on, move out, pass away. Any number of life changes could happen between now and the next 5 years for the people along the lines, myself included. My apartment is going to be in its path. I think it's either going to come right in front. They're going to build the track in the road, kind of in that funny corner where Highway 7 and Lake Street meet, or they're going to build it to go behind the railroad tracks. There, just what is it, the Calhoun Isles Shopping Center? There's those railroad tracks might go back there as well and head back south. So it'll certainly be disruptive, and I don't doubt it. But come 5-10 years from now, if it is actually completed on time, which I doubt, it might be kind of a relative deprivation type of thing, where now that you have it, you kind of like it, and now you don't want to let it go. And even though some people might have been opposed to it 5-10 years ago, now that there's a new culture within the city 10 years later, things could change and attitudes could change. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I, as someone who lives along this proposed route, am not necessarily warm to it, but we'll see where it goes. My best hope is that it won't be wasteful, but with a $2 billion price tag, we're beyond that point already.
How's it not wasteful? There is not a single fixed rail project in the Twin Cities that is even on track to earn its money back in the lifetime of operation.
I agree with you. And this is going to cost $138 million per mile. That's certainly not fiscally conservative in any sense of the word.
Look at this. So in 2016, when I ran for office, I ran against the Southwest Light Rail. Now, it didn't work out for me because there's a lot of metro-centric people out there who want it and virtue signal about it specific to the Southwest Light Rail. The proposed cost all in, with the proposed maintenance costs on a year-to-year basis, you could lease everybody a Cadillac in Minneapolis for 1 year, and it would not equate to 2/3 of the cost of the Southwest Light Rail over the course of 10 years. So all that to be said, it's not a project that makes sense. Fixed rail in Minnesota doesn't make any money. We're actually not a dense enough city for any of the projects to make sense, and nobody rides them. It's just really, it is a virtue signal piece of legislation. It doesn't make much sense. There are other, and when we're actually talking about, in principle, fixed rail as a form of transportation or a long-term solution, it doesn't make much sense when we talk about autonomous vehicles. We talk about potential flight travel. These are things that we could be forward thinking on and investing in, and we're not, because we're stuck on trains.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the Southwest Metro, we'd like to hear your opinion. 651-989-5855. Again, 651-989-5855. Brad and Max here. Closing argument with Walter Hudson filling in. To your point, you were talking about Republicans need to find issues to rally around. Maybe this will be the issue to gain suburban voters back. Once this construction starts and people start seeing their lives disrupted, Republicans might have some firepower of, hey, look at how this lefty project is interfering with your life. Look at how your home is being affected and your neighbors are being affected. And it might be an effective strategy here on the state level.
Well, I think just as a reality, too, the fact that it's going to cost so much, be forward thinking on transportation. Fixed rail is multiple hundreds of years old technology that we're relying on as the future of our mass transit. It doesn't make sense from a practical sense, because you have fixed destinations and fixed starting points when we have technologies in place between autonomous vehicles, flight transportation, and GPS technology being what it is right now and evolving into what it's going to be in the next 10 years. Fixed rail as a principle doesn't make sense. It's just legislation and initiatives that make people feel good, especially the Southwest Light Rail project. Beyond that, it was just rammed down our throats. The feds pulled the funding for it. The Met Council decided that they were going to find the funding, which will be a combination of property tax increases in the long run and then bonding projects. It doesn't make sense. I'm very disappointed, unfortunately, that we elected people who are not going to stand up against this.
Yeah, even if it was more funding for buses, you know, like buses have a thing called an axle. They can turn corners. They don't have to go along one single rail. But I don't know exactly who does the Met Council have in mind as the ideal user of this. Everyone? Because not everyone's going to use it. You know, do they have a specific thing in mind? I remember it must have been back in a debate or something with Governor Dayton. He said something along the lines of, talented young people in the Twin Cities take public transportation and they want this. They're demanding this. But I must not be a talented young person, or I must not be talented because I don't, you know, I'm going to drive my car for as long as I can. That's my thing. I'm not going to rely on anybody else's schedule to, because that's the thing. It's a drastic shift in your life to be on the light rail schedule. Right. You can't just get in your car and go. You're increasing dependency on the system. Getting some calls on the issues. We will take your calls on the other side of the break here on the Southwest Light Rail cleared for construction. 651-989-5855. Brad and Max in for Walter on closing argument on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
620, then we'll update you on the fight for 15 and why it's likely to happen statewide.
Plus, everything the FDA gets wrong about vaping.
Justice and Drew, live and local, 6 to 9, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
This is Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. My name is Brad Omland, joined tonight in studio with co-host Max Reimer of the Kip and Max Save the World podcast, filling in for Walter tonight on Closing Argument. We want to know where the light rail hurt you. Your call is welcome, 651-989-5855, now that the Southwest Light Rail Project officially funded and set to begin construction. Let's go to Bryce from Eden Prairie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, guys. One question that I've been asking, and I haven't heard, you know, Justice and Drew ask it, I haven't heard Walter ask it, and where you go to find why this has been so prevalent and being pushed, you know, over such a long period is, where's the money? Who, you know, who's getting the money here? Is there going to be kickbacks to somebody? Is there a certain favored construction company? You have to follow the money to find out why that you know, it's not just because this is an altruistic move and, you know, we want to do the best for the environment. There's definitely somebody with that amount of money involved that's behind it. And I don't know if there's anybody in this part of the state that's willing to do any investigative journalism to figure that out, because that's the first question I would ask, and I'd love to hear you guys on this station ask it more.
Yeah, we appreciate your call, Bryce. And that is a fair question. You have to follow the money in these projects, but these projects, especially major ones like this that have multiple funding sources, have been years in the making. You know, we have been known this was coming, and the Met Council has been trying to get various fundings from the state, from local governments, and even from the federal government. There is a significant number of dollars coming from the federal government as well that were allocated a decade ago now. There was a similar, not a light rail project, but a federally and state-funded project that came through my hometown, and people were not happy about it, but it was like, well, this was put in place decades ago. Now that it's here, we're kind of over a barrel if you're objected to it, because it's happened. The money's been appropriated, but
isn't that the funny thing about all these projects?
Oh no, definitely.
Is that you say that, hey, you guys have this federal money to spend, or you have this money allocated for a certain project, and then they hold a gun to your head saying, now if you don't spend it, you're going to lose it, and your town's going to get destroyed, and we're just going to take this money from you. It's the most warped sense of it. And to Bryce's point, follow the money. At the end of the day, all of these jobs based on government requirements, based on what the state of Minnesota makes you do as a federal contractor, all of this money, Bryce, is going to unions. Follow the money. That's where it's going. It is going into the pockets of people who will continue to propagate Democrat causes. Because, by the way, most labor unions are not handing out pamphlets to vote for Jeff Johnson. They were handing out pamphlets to vote for Tim Walz to protect the institutions that continue to fund them. It's not like any of these companies that are getting the contracts awarded to them are going to be doing so under the impression that they don't need to work with union contractors. The way that we have set it up in the state of Minnesota is that preferred vendors, etc., it's union labor. It's all union labor. And if you did have an investigative journalist dig into that, I'm sure you would find corruption all over the place, like you find with daycare fraud, what you find with other, I'm not even going to, with Minlars, with Minsure, how those contracts were awarded, who got the labor, how the money was spent. There's going to be corruption all over the place. There's going to be corruption on this project. And all of it will lead to more money and financing for labor unions.
Yeah, it's an old story, unfortunately, here in Minnesota. And part of the reason why it's not transparent is because there are these extra congressional or extra legislative committees. You know, the legislature just makes a committee and sends the responsibility there so that they're not taking care of it. Their vote isn't on the line. So now, you know, we don't elect the Met Council, do
no.
we? They're appointed.
No.
And so we don't have a voice in this as voters anymore. That has been our own legislature, our own representatives have surrendered this power to these unelected committees. And I think that is particularly concerning and something that you should consider as a voter. Get more reaction from the Southwest Metro here. Your call's welcome, 651-989-5855. Let's go to John from Eden Prairie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of comments, and then I want to get your thoughts about it. I think last segment you said something that Mark Dayton said that lots of young people are enthusiastic about taking the light rail. I live like 5 minutes away, and I remember a light rail specifically a Southwest Metro bus going straight to the U of M campus. So, I mean, when I used to ride that bus, the only people that would ride it were business people and college kids. So who's going to ride the light rail? And second of all, it's like, who are we as Minnesotans trying to be like? Japan? I mean, what's next? The bullet train? I don't know. I think it's just a bad mix altogether. Like the last caller said, there's so much corruption. I mean, follow the trail. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for your call, John. And yeah, that is similar frustration that I think I share the same idea with you. Who is going to ride this? Who is it that you're targeting? And like, you know, John said that he lived in Eden Prairie and rode the bus to the U of M. But how many people are doing that?
But then beyond that, to John's point, what's wrong with that? What was so wrong with the bus system that we need a brand new $2 billion a year upfront cost and then multi-million dollar a year to maintain cost of the Southwest Light Rail? What was wrong with the public transportation that we had in place, aka the bus system, that you could divert if roads were down, that did not have a fixed end and a fixed beginning, and that, by the way, did not cost near per mile that the Southwest Light Rail is going to cost? And by the way, this is not the last we have heard from it. This is going to be a project, like all government projects, that they make plans and provisions and supposedly do the environmental research on. And then at the end of the day, there will be cost overruns to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And the Metropolitan Council has taxing authority when it comes to property taxes and other taxes that we have no say in over. These are unelected bureaucrats that get to decide these projects and tax us accordingly. Not to be too extreme, but I mean, this is the type of stuff that we had a revolution over.
You're spot on.
It's just fascinating to me that we continue to allow this in Minnesota, but as of elections that happened 2 weeks ago, signify we're obviously not, as a state, super concerned about it.
Well, again, we're asking for it, and we get the government we ask for. You are allowing your legislators to do this when you elect them, and as voters, apparently we aren't holding them accountable because these are Democratic projects. There was a blue wave in Minnesota, and these are going to continue. You know, and yeah, to your point, Max, they say 5 years, $2 billion.
Come on,
it's going to be closer to 10 years, $4 billion.
Of course, and They will find the money in other places. Listen, if you want a tale as old as time, I'm going to take out my crystal ball right now. And this crystal ball is based on the last 10 government projects that Minnesota has taken on, major projects from MinSure to MinLars to others. And this is not even a digital project. This is physical infrastructure that we're talking about here. My crystal ball tells me that this will have cost overruns and nearly double in total initial cost than what is projected to be. And keep in mind, Brad, to your point, they've spent a decade planning this thing. They've already spent hundreds of millions of dollars planning this thing. And because it's government, with all the planning that they've already done, it's still going to have cost overruns, and it's still going to not make any money in the long run. That's another key lie that we need to really call out on projects like this, is they say, oh, well, over time, there's a return on the investment there. There is not. There is not a return, a positive return, a cash positive return on investment on any rail project in the entire country, save for Washington, D.C., because Washington, D.C., nobody has transportation of their own. It's dense enough where you can actually have the population and people pay for their ticket. No one pays for the Denver Transit, by the way. They just jump the line and they get in the train and no one pays for it. This will be much of the same. There is no return on investment. There never will be. And this project will have totally run amok by the time it's done.
Your call is welcome in the Southwest Metro, 651-989-5855. Brad and Max in for Walter Hudson tonight on Closing Argument. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, online at twincitiesnewstalk.com. My name is Brad Omland, joined tonight in studio by Max Reimer of the Kevin Max Save the World podcast. We are co-hosting for Walter tonight as he attends to his municipal duties. We're talking the Southwest Light Rail Project, and in our last segment here, let's bring that discussion into the station, you could say. I was looking, you know, we had talked about return on investment for these big projects that the Met Council funds. The last big project that we had here in Minnesota was the construction of U.S. Bank Stadium. And of course, the way that Dayton wanted to fund that was through pull tabs. And I think that the jury is largely still out or not favoring Dayton in terms of how much money they generated. I found that generally when politicians make estimates on how much money something will generate, you can generally move the decimal point one spot to the left, and that's actually where you'll find
it.
I was reading a MinPost article here on U.S. Bank Stadium and just kind of, you know, its benefits and whatnot, and it's basically mostly negative or, you know, lukewarm at best. You know, it was just kind of ambiguous in terms of the actual benefits. But one thing that stood out to me here was that it was, you know, the NFL itself doesn't generate enough event or doesn't have enough events to really generate a long-term stimulus outside of the 8 weeks that there's a home game here in Minnesota. But who it was beneficial to was the property owners next to U.S. Bank Stadium and the businesses sure. that own properties, because they've got an instant subsidy and an instant audience at least 8 weeks a year, and it's just huge, and it increases their property value substantially. And what my next thought was here with this Southwest Light Rail project is that it's not necessarily about the rail, it's about the land. And it will be because it's all through, what is it, liens and easements that the government does this. And the same debate emerged from when the rails went west and, you know, the expansion of the U.S. and Manifest Destiny back in the 1800s. There was a lot of controversy between the rails wanting to expand and the farmers themselves owning the land. That, you know, it was actually who owns the land, who gets access to it. And generally, the people with the money, the rail and the power, the railways, won. And they got that land. And so not only is the rail valuable for their own economic gain, but the land around the rail is valuable as well. And what we'll see here after the light rail project gets completed, because the government will have easements in the property immediately surrounding the rail lines, guess what they can put there? Housing, property, affordable housing. It'll be they'll expand the web of affordable housing outside of Minneapolis and across the metro.
Yeah, that's the point. That's the ultimate central planning that they want to accomplish. And groups like the Met Council are all about central planning, smaller houses, subsidized housing, getting on the grid, controlling the general population. Groups like this and bigger and expanding government, this is what they want to do. Now, with that said, I mean, that is the justification. When you have the Green Line coming through and the Southwest Light Rail coming through, the justification for property owners is that your property will increase and the perceived value does increase. Most economic studies find that. The actual economic benefit to whatever community the light rail is going through, it's a wash. There is no viable study that proves otherwise. It just doesn't. But you're right. Speculative property goes up in value, and that's mainly real estate investors and things of that nature that set that value. So I don't know. I'm not convinced that there's going to be any kind of economic benefit to it.
Finally tonight, Max and I here in the studio are not watching Fox News. We are watching some Monday Night Football. History in the making here in the NFL. Both teams have scored more than 50 points.
And it's not over yet. It's not over yet. It seems that the game's in the fourth quarter. And, yeah, just an unbelievable game. 54-51, the Los Angeles Rams are leading the Kansas City Chiefs right now. And I don't know. We just haven't seen a football game quite like this. Kansas City driving with 50 seconds left in the game, down by 3 points.
Well, we started our hour with NFL discussion and Condoleezza Rice with the Browns. But I think that this games like this kind of show that the NFL is surviving its political wave. There was, you know, when the Colin Kaepernick controversy was at its peak, there was a lot of reports that that NFL ratings were down, and it was because of all this controversy, it was because of all the politics, it was because of Red Zone. But this season we've seen that NFL ratings have been back up, and I think it's because of games like this that we're witnessing now.
Yeah, and I think the talent gap is closing a little bit, and the NFL is getting some stars again, which is a big part of it, having marketable stars. But there is no doubt in my mind that both politics from an actual in-game standpoint and then political climate was affecting the NFL. I think during the 2016 season, which was actually the NFL's worst year, we did have an election to pay attention to, and then it doesn't help that the NFL is kind of tempering its rules to more of a modern finesse game, less big hits and that kind of thing. I think there's a generation that wants to still see the old NFL come back.
Well, and even to tie that back into our previous discussion with the light rail, there was a lot of public subsidies that went to the NFL to host the Super Bowl here. The NFL makes a list of demands, and basically the city governments and the state government, they comply with it. And
yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
All these economic benefits purported, did we see them?
No, and we never will. And that's the sad truth of it. And we'll have to have another conversation for another night on that specific topic, because it's one of the most disgraceful things that that exists in modern politics today.
As you could say, the NFL is running up the score, and that's what we're seeing here tonight on Closing Argument with Walter Hudson. Brad and Max co-hosting tonight. Walter will be back tomorrow night, but we've got a short week here with Thanksgiving coming up. We will air a replay of Gophers basketball following Gophers basketball on Wednesday night. I know that's a earlier game, so you know it might get done 9:30 or so. So you can still hear us for a little while between 9 and 11, but otherwise catch the Gophers basketball team, which had a good win on Sunday night. Probably the only thing to salvage from the Minnesota sports weekend that was. And then Thursday is Thanksgiving. That will obviously be a replay. And then Friday night we have Gophers hockey, and then maybe an hour or so of best of replay. Hopefully we've got enough segments for Brianna. She runs the board. And we thank you for tuning in tonight. This has been Brad and Max in for Walter on Closing Argument. Walter will be back in studio tomorrow night, and it looks here that the Rams have achieved victory, taking the kneel down 54-51. We are taking a knee here too on Twin Cities News Talk AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
But we're not kneeling for the anthem.